Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Officially, it's called an agreement for bringing peace to Afghanistan. The agreement was signed by the U.S. and the Taliban on Saturday, and if it holds, it could signal an end to the longest war in U.S. history, a war that has killed and wounded thousands of U.S. troops and cost more than $2 trillion. A few days after the agreement, problems are already surfacing. Is peace possible in this war-torn nation?
The agreement set out the conditions, it set out the space, but no, this deal doesn't depend upon trusting anyone. It has a deep, complex, well-thought-out, multi-month negotiated verification complex and mechanism by which we can observe and hold every member of the agreement accountable. We'll do that. It's not about trust. It's about what happens on the ground, not only yesterday, which was an important day, but in the days that follow.
That is Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and he made those comments on Sunday, the day after the agreement was signed on Face the Nation. Already, there have been some changes just this morning. There was an airstrike by the U.S. against the Taliban. Joining us today is Dr. Chris Mason, Assistant Professor of National Security with the Strategic Studies Institute at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. He is considered an expert on Afghanistan. Dr. Mason, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on. I have to start with the standard caveat that the views expressed this morning are my own and not those of the Department of Defense or the United States government.
And totally expect that. So thank you very much for letting our audience know. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number 1-800-729-7532. The agreement was signed last Saturday. What are the provisions of the deal reached between the U.S. and the Taliban? What do the two sides agree to?
It's going to be a fairly long iterative process that began with the 7-day reduction in violence, to be followed by the drawdown of some 3,600 U.S. troops within the next 145 days. That then would be followed by what are being called the inter-Afghan talks or the inter-Afghan dialogue, which should not be misconstrued as a discussion between the Taliban and the existing Afghan government, but a more broad discussion between the Taliban and members of Afghan society, which may include government officials, not in an official capacity.
Why not the Afghan government?
The Taliban have maintained consistently for the last 16 years that they do not recognize the current government of Afghanistan. They call them the puppet government, much as the North Vietnamese government during the Vietnam War referred to the Saigon government as the puppet government. And they refuse to legitimize, in their view, that government by talking with them as equals.
Well, then what chance for peace is there if the government in Afghanistan, even though the Taliban's not recognizing them, what chance for peace is there if that government is not involved in the talks?
I think, frankly, very little. This was not, in any sense, a peace deal or a peace treaty. This is a U.S. troop withdrawal agreement.
And that's what it comes down to. I want to ask this question. U.S. and NATO pledged to remove all troops within 14 months if the Taliban upholds its end of the bargain. Now, at a press conference earlier this week, though, President Trump said he expected the troops to start coming home that day. Will the U.S. withdraw troops no matter what, no matter what the Taliban does?
My understanding is that Secretary of Defense Mark Esper spoke with the theater commander, General Scott Miller, just within the last 24 hours and said, we're going to go forward with this phased reduction, beginning with the 3,600 troops over the next 145 days. However, any reduction below that level will be dependent on events on the ground.
So what are any of those events on the ground spelled out? As I said, the U.S. Had an airstrike today, and the Taliban, even since Saturday, there hasn't been the kind of fighting that was going on before, but still.
Now, the reduction in violence very specifically lasted 7 days, and the Taliban have announced that they're going to resume normal combat operations. The Afghan Ministry of Defense said within the last 24 hours that there have been at least 73 Taliban-initiated attacks across 24 provinces of Afghanistan, in addition to the American airstrike carried out in Helmand province within the last few hours.
So I guess, you know, for those of us who are hearing that says, well, that doesn't sound like two sides living up to an agreement if fighting continues.
That the Taliban have maintained the same policy that the North Vietnamese did in Vietnam of fight and talk, as it's called. They will continue to fight while talks go on. I think the real stumbling block is whether or not the Taliban are in any way willing to negotiate with the current power structure in Kabul in any meaningful sense to arrive at some sort of power-sharing arrangement. I think that's highly unlikely based on the Taliban's philosophy and the sense that they have that they're winning.
They still feel that they're winning.
I think to a man in the rank and file, there's a confidence that they're going to win. And although their progress has certainly been glacial over the last couple of years, they are making slow progress in the rural areas and consolidating control over small villages and small settlements. Certainly the Afghan government controls all of the major cities and population areas, but that only represents about 20% of the Afghan population overall. About 80% of the people in Afghanistan still live in the rural areas, pretty much the same proportion as was the case in Vietnam.
You know, what you've been talking about just in here, the first few minutes of the program, I think it's probably wise to go back and talk about Afghanistan itself, that even though there may be some comparisons to Vietnam, Afghanistan, several of the countries in that region, Pakistan, for example, in the western regions of Pakistan, that this is not like neighborhoods or it's tribal areas. And even some of those that are anti-Taliban may not be on board with the government of Afghanistan, right? I mean, so doesn't this complicate it a whole lot?
It surely does. I think one of the central problems here is that the government that we've tried to establish in Afghanistan has, by any measure, underperformed and is widely seen by the population at large as the government in Saigon was during the American involvement in Vietnam, as largely corrupt, incompetent, and illegitimate. There's an old saying that elections don't make democracy. Democracy makes elections. And the low voter turnout in the elections held last year are certainly indicative that a majority of the population are not on board with the current Afghan government. Whichever man ultimately prevails in the election results, Abdullah Abdullah or Ashraf Ghani, the current president of Afghanistan, either man will have about 3 to 3.5% of the total eligible voter count in Afghanistan when the election is said and done. 3% of the electorate is not really a mandate for governance.
That may surprise a lot of Americans that over the years, especially first few years, when we would see, and this was in Iraq too, that people coming out of the polls with the thumbs marked, that I think a lot of people thought that there were Afghans that were hungry for democracy and that took that right to vote or took the vote seriously. But when you're saying only 3% of eligible voters, yeah, that's far from a representation of the country.
I think that's right. The population of Afghanistan is somewhere around 32 to 34 million people. There has never been a census done. One was attempted in the 1970s and was never completed for any number of social and cultural reasons. Perhaps 22 million Afghans are old enough to vote, and of those, somewhere around 1,800,000 votes were cast in the election held last year, at least 300,000 of which technically are invalid because they're date stamped after the polls closed. Those are the ones that are in contention now, because almost all 300,000 were for Ashraf Ghani. And those are the 300,000 that put him over the 50% threshold to 50.1%. If those 300,000 were not counted, neither man would have obtained a majority under the election rules, and you'd have to have a runoff election.
You mentioned a few minutes ago how the population views the Afghan government, legitimacy aside. Corruption has been a very serious problem in this country and a lot of countries throughout the world. But is the government corrupt? Some of the things that the people think about the government, are they right?
I think so. There's the annual transparency index that's published by a nonpartisan research group that found that Afghanistan was the second most corrupt country on earth last year. And in previous years, it was either one or two on the list for corruption. I don't believe Ashraf Ghani himself is involved in the corruption. I believe he's a decent man. But certainly at every level of the government, beneath Ashraf Ghani, there's endemic corruption. And that goes all the way down to the district level, where policemen are taking bribes and so-called transit fees for vehicles and so on.
Mm. It seems as though the U.S. strategy here, to some extent, would be to just get out no matter what after 19 years, that we have not achieved our objectives. Is it time to bring, and it is time to bring the troops home regardless. That idea seems to be shared by not just by President Trump, but even some of the Democratic presidential candidates, that, and a lot of Americans, that this war has gone on for too long. We've not achieved objectives. How accurate is that?
I think it's fair to say that we achieved the objectives that we were aiming for in October and November 2001, which was to effect a regime change in Kabul, take the Taliban out of power, and hunt down and kill the majority of al-Qaeda in the country. What happened after that is traditionally called mission creep, in which we decided to stay on and try to set up a democratic government in Afghanistan and develop the country into a more modern state. And I think that's where the wheels started to come off the train.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. You can see some of the shows we're working on for the future, including a Smart Talk road trip to Wilson College in Chambersburg a week from tomorrow, Thursday, March 12th, to talk about women's suffrage. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving a voicemail at WITF.org/smarttalk. Today we're talking about the agreement, called officially the Agreement for Bringing Peace to Afghanistan, signed over the weekend between the United States and the Taliban. Our guest is Dr. Chris Mason, Assistant Professor of National Security with the Strategic Studies Institute at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. He's an expert on Afghanistan. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We were talking about objectives, and you mentioned that the U.S. probably meet our objectives at the early part of the war in 2001. And the big part of that was getting rid of al-Qaeda, or getting al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan, Taliban, Afghanistan providing a safe haven for terrorists. That is a part of this deal. The Taliban apparently has agreed to not harbor al-Qaeda or terrorist groups. What do you know about that? What can you tell us about that?
It's a complex issue. The Taliban, in the first place, might have the intention of banning terrorist groups from operating on its own soil, but the capability of preventing that, I think, is a whole nother issue. Afghanistan is four times the size of South Vietnam. There's a lot of places to hide there. I think it's entirely possible that terrorist groups could find shelter there, even without the Taliban's permission. Another factor is the so-called Haqqani network, or the Haqqani group, which forms a part of the various factions that we refer to collectively as the Taliban. Sirajuddin Haqqani, the eldest son of the founder of the group, is the number two man in the Taliban leadership structure, and the Haqqani network is classified as a terrorist group by the United States government. Also, ISIS-K or ISIS Khorasan is operating still in Nangarhar province, although both the United States and the Taliban are fighting against them. So there's already a terrorist group on Afghan soil, ISIS-K, which would very much like to carry out attacks on the United States or our interests, although it's still a relatively small group, and I don't know how long their reach is. But certainly policing that agreement, policing that part of the agreement on the Taliban's part would be difficult, to say the least.
We have a question from a listener ask, if the goal was to kick out Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, but the Taliban's still there and will likely resume power in the country eventually, who is worse for Afghanistan, the Taliban or Al-Qaeda? Who is worse for U.S. interest?
Well, by far, Al-Qaeda would be worse for U.S. interests. I don't see any potential of Al-Qaeda, per se, having a role in the future government of Afghanistan, but I think it's virtually certain that the Taliban will have a role. The Taliban have said they are only interested internally in Afghanistan. They're not interested in projecting power or influence outside of Afghanistan. I think the major issue now is to what extent would the Taliban respect gains in Afghan society made over the last 20 years, particularly in the area of education and women's rights.
Okay, two huge issues right there. Taliban, when it was in complete control in 2001 and before, those were two of the huge issue. Human rights, especially the rights of women, basically they had none. Education, girls, young girls, women could not be educated, could not go to school. Those are things that have changed since 2001. Has the Taliban indicated any willingness to respect some of the changes that have been made over the years? I mean, this is a religious issue with the Taliban. The way they read Islam is that this is not supposed to happen. Have they shown any willingness to go along with the progress that has been made? Is what we in the West see as progress.
Their actions are not matching up to their words. They have taken what you might call a kinder, gentler tone in regard to girls going to school. They've said that women, you know, if appropriately segregated from men, could be able to work, and that girls could go to school up to a certain age as long as Islamic principles as they view them are upheld. But the reality is, in areas that have been retaken by the Taliban and are now fully under Taliban control, girls are not allowed to go to school, and we're seeing much the same kind of seclusion of women from the workplace and from the public sphere that we saw when the Taliban were in power from 1996 to 2001. So the rhetoric is there, but I haven't seen that in terms of implementation.
I guess the bottom line question for that then would be, why would the U.S. agree to a deal that does not include human rights improvements, that some willingness to respect those human rights?
I think at this point, the polls show that the majority of the American people want our forces out of Afghanistan and want to let the Afghans solve their own problems and you know, come to their own political arrangements. What's happening in Afghanistan is a civil war. It has been for decades. The dictionary definition of a civil war is two groups of citizens from the same country fighting each other. It's hard to make a case that that's not what's going on today in Afghanistan. And I think that's likely to continue whether we're there or not.
Hmm. little bit of history here. I'm curious your thoughts on this. We've heard people say over the years that if the Bush administration had not made the decision to invade Iraq, and that all the attention of the U.S. military and diplomacy was focused on Afghanistan, that we wouldn't be in the situation we are right now, that this war would have ended a long time ago. U.S. may have met its objectives. What do you think about that?
I understand that's an attractive narrative, but I don't think that holds any water. The problem in Afghanistan, as it was in Vietnam, is not military; it's political. Studies and surveys and analysis over decades and dozens of conflicts have shown that if the central government that's fighting against some sort of an internal rebellion or a political movement like the Taliban is not seen as broadly legitimate to rule the country, the numbers show something like 85% or 90% of the population accepting the government as legitimate, the government never succeeds. I think that the bottom line is the Taliban are more motivated. The Taliban have virtually infinite number of recruits, and they're willing to fight as long as it's going to take, in their view, to regain control of the country. And frankly, with 3.5% of the eligible voters supporting Ashraf Ghani or Abdullah, the sense of legitimacy and support, popular support for the existing government's just not there. It wasn't there in South Vietnam. It's not there in Afghanistan today.
You made a lot of references to Vietnam. How does this compare?
I think in a strategic sense, in a conceptual sense, the conflicts are very much alike. In both cases, the United States fought a land war in Asia, 9,000 miles from our own shores. We tried to establish Western democracies in countries that had no experience of them. And in both cases, we supported governments that were seen by the vast majority of the people as incompetent, corrupt, and illegitimate. In both cases, I think we relied on American technology and air power and conducted wars of attrition to apply a military solution to a political problem. In both cases, the movements, the NVA and the Viet Cong in Vietnam, of course, and the Taliban in Afghanistan have the support of a neighboring nuclear power in which they can gain sanctuary and get resupplied and refunded, regroup and reorganize virtually at will. The United States could not control the cross-border sanctuary of the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese into Laos and Cambodia. And nuclear-armed China backed them throughout the war from the beginning, as nuclear-armed Pakistan has done with the Taliban for their own political reasons since the start of the conflict.
Then why didn't the U.S. learn from the lessons of Vietnam? I mean, since the Vietnam War ended in 1973, there was a treaty, but 75 really pointed to the end of the war when North Vietnam took over altogether. You know, often we would hear the lessons of Vietnam. Why didn't we learn from that?
Well, there's a lot of scholarship about that very subject. I think the academic consensus is that the U.S. military decided they didn't want to do that again. The main lesson drawn from the Vietnam War was we're not going to have any more of those kinds of conflicts, which led to the Powell Doctrine and so on. I think there was a very conscious pivot away from guerrilla warfare, counterinsurgency, and involvement in foreign internal conflict, to the ability to fight a major theater war against someone like the Soviet Union. And I see the same things happening now after the Afghanistan war. There's already been talk in the U.S. Army about pivoting away from small wars, foreign internal conflict, to what's being called a near-peer conflict with Russia potentially, or China as a potential adversary somewhere down the road.
One of the differences, though, between Afghanistan and Vietnam is the attention span of the American people. I mean, one of the big differences is that one of the reasons that Vietnam was so unpopular, one of the reasons, was that many of those fighting the war were drafted. In this case, it's an all-volunteer force, and I don't know what the percentage is, but I know it's very low of American families who have members in the military who were actually in Afghanistan. So it was almost out of sight, out of mind, that it didn't get the kind of attention that Vietnam did. What about that? I mean, that's a big difference.
It is. It's a huge difference. I think it's very unfortunate, growing chasm between our military personnel, those who fight, and civil society. It didn't used to be the case. After World War II, virtually everyone had a family member who'd been in the conflict. Even during the Korean War, participation in the military was widespread. I think that's a social issue, probably beyond the boundaries of Afghanistan today. But I think it certainly is an issue of some concern that those who decide and those who fight now are so far apart, and that gap is widening.
I wonder, would this war have gone on as long as it has, 18 years going on 19 years, if the American people were more vested in it?
That's a good question. They always say never answer a hypothetical question. Certainly, the opposition to the Vietnam War, the anti-war protests, essentially stopped when the draft was ended. I think a lot of that was driven by a desire to avoid participation in the Vietnam War on the part of many student protesters. If we still had a draft today, hypothetically, perhaps there would be more vocal opposition to the war.
We only have a minute or so left, and I want to thank you, Dr. Mason, for being with us today. So what's the future hold? I mean, I have to admit that just on a personal basis, it doesn't sound real optimistic, other than this is an opportunity for the U.S. to get out of Afghanistan.
It's not only an opportunity for the United States to get out of Afghanistan, it's an opportunity for the Afghan people to sort out their political differences and try to find some sort of modus vivendi. I am pessimistic about the future. I don't think this is going to lead to any sort of negotiated settlement, and I think the civil war is likely to continue for some years to come.
And along those lines, as of today, and you touched on this earlier, the Taliban controls more than half of the country, and the Gandhi regime has already said, you know, they're skeptical of this, and you, as you said yourself, the regime, Gandhi regime, is not even involved in the negotiations. So I think, like I asked this question earlier, but I can understand you being pessimistic that this will be successful if you don't even have the government involved in the negotiations.
I hear the ghosts of Vietnam everywhere in this, and not least of all in this agreement, where the national government of in Saigon or in Kabul were excluded from the discussions and handed sort of a fait accompli after the negotiations had been concluded. The Ghani government has already said that they're not going to release the 5,000 Taliban prisoners required as one of the incremental steps in this drawdown agreement.
A prisoner exchange, yeah.
The prisoner exchange, the government said that's not going to happen. The fighting has already resumed in the rural areas, and the Taliban is unlikely to negotiate away in some sort of inter-Afghan talks that which they can gain on the battlefield.
So the bottom line is U.S. troops may come home.
They may and they may not. This has been called conditions-based. And if the Taliban and these talks don't make progress towards what we would consider a satisfactory outcome, we may very well leave residual forces in Afghanistan for some time.
That was my next question. Can a case be made for keeping a much smaller force in Afghanistan?
I think it can, depending on what your objectives are. Certainly having the U.S. forces there training and supporting the Afghan national security forces have slowed Taliban progress to a glacial pace over the last 2 or 3 years, and could provide some space for the political dialogue to take place. When the United States, or if the United States, withdraws all of its forces, all of its air power and so on from Afghanistan, I don't know any analysts who believe the Afghan government and security forces can stand on their own.
Dr. Chris Mason is Assistant Professor of National Security at the Strategic Studies Institute at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we discuss Real ID. It's something that there's a lot of confusion about Real ID. It seems like every day you hear about someone who attempted to get Real ID with their driver's license and didn't have the correct documentation, or they just had some questions about it. We've actually addressed this on the program before, and we had a lot of questions, so we will continue to ask those questions on tomorrow's program. You can leave a voicemail or voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. More information is at WITF.org/smarttalk. March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. Colon cancer is one of the most preventable types of cancer and can be treated successfully if detected early. But the tests for colorectal cancers are often what keep those at risk from getting screened. What are the symptoms, risk factors, and how is colorectal cancer treated? During Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, we examine those questions today with our guest, Dr. Purvi Panchal. She's a Pennsylvania gastroenterology affiliated with Geisinger Health. Mike McCormick is a financial advisor living in Hershey. In 2005, he survived stage 4 tonsil cancer, and in 2017-18 fought the battle against tongue cancer twice. He's a member of a volunteer leadership council for the capital market for the American Cancer Society, and we'll be talking about the second annual Striking Chords Against Cancer fundraiser in the Harrisburg-Hershey area. Welcome to both of you for being on the program today.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having us.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Panchal, let me start with you, and we'll start with one of the basic questions. What is colorectal cancer?
Well,
cancers, I should say.
Yes. So they are cancers that arise in the colon and the rectum, and they are the second leading cause of cancer deaths in both men and women in the U.S. population.
You say both men and women. Is there a percentage breakdown? Between men and women who suffer from colorectal cancers?
It can happen, obviously, to both, and it's the second leading cause for both
right.
men and
but
women.
I guess what I was looking for is whether men are more likely to get it than women or vice versa. No?
No.
It could be a 50-50. It could be a 50-50 breakdown. So how does it develop?
So it develops from polyps that form in the colon. Those are abnormal cells that continue to multiply and then form growths in the colon. And those are asymptomatic initially. So the reason we advocate for colonoscopy as a screening protocol to detect early colon cancer is that we can find these polyps early. And if we find them early enough, they can be removed during the colonoscopy. And once you remove them, you've helped prevent colon cancer from forming. Or if we do a colonoscopy and we find an early stage cancer, then that can be treated. And early stage cancers have a 90% survival rate at 5 years. So the whole goal is early detection. Even if it is not found early, once it is found, we can gauge treatment accordingly.
But as you said yourself, one of the challenges or the hurdles that we face is that it may show no symptoms even
Correct.
If there is a cancer there.
Correct. So the common misconception for people is that I feel fine, I move my bowels regularly, I'm not experiencing any bleeding, why do I need to go for a colonoscopy? But that's the exact reason why you should, because you need to find these before you have a problem so that they can be treated.
So, you know, I don't want to say this is the bottom line, but one of the main hurdles is that there are so many people who just, because going for a colonoscopy mm-hmm. is so unpleasant, it's actually the prep, quite frankly,
Correct.
Speaking from experience,
yes.
that is so unpleasant. I mean, nowadays you're put to sleep mm-hmm. or, you know, you don't feel the pain. But the prep is so unpleasant that people avoid it, right?
Correct. And what we're trying to reach out and make people more aware of is that although the prep is unpleasant and, you know, to have that clean out to be prepared for the colonoscopy, that's one day of discomfort and uncomfortable experience. But the colonoscopy itself, you're sedated for. And if you can prevent colon cancer, then you're saving your life.
So who's at risk?
So basically, polyps tend to grow more after the age of 50. And now there's more data coming out that we're seeing polyps in earlier ages too. So there's some change in the guidelines potentially to age 45. But it can happen to men, to women, any race. And so basically, we're advocating for screening at age 50 and potentially moving it up to 45.
This does not seem to be the kind of thing that many people would volunteer for, where they would say, I'm 45, I'm 50, it's time to get a colonoscopy. This is something, though, that just my own experience, the family doctor asks on a regular basis.
Yes, and that's the mindset that we're strongly trying to change. It should be something that not only the physicians, but also people themselves should be asking for, because this will help protect you for the rest of your life. Preventing cancer and preventing the consequences of cancer is a major goal of the community.
Now, you talked about risk. What about genetic factors and environmental factors?
Sure. So let's start with genetic factors. So polyps and cancer can run in families. So say someone has their screening colonoscopy at age 50 and we find precancerous colon polyps. That will change the screening for their first-degree relatives. Siblings, children, they would all need to start screening by age 40. So there are certain guidelines that we use for family history. They will basically start their screening early and get their colonoscopies more frequently. But this does not mean that if you have no family history that you don't get a colonoscopy. Colonoscopy is recommended in people who have no risk because the whole goal is to find these polyps that develop.
Mm-hmm. And once you have had polyps, maybe that even were non-cancerous, uh-huh. but had them removed, mm-hmm. are you more at risk?
Yeah, so there are different types of polyps, and certainly certain types of polyps carry that increased risk. So even if we remove those polyps at that time, they are at increased risk for developing more over time. So the guidelines for them would be, depending on the size, the number, the type, they might need another colonoscopy in 5 years, 3 years. So each screening protocol is then adjusted and individualized for the patient.
Can polyps go away on their own?
No.
No,
they have to be
surgically removed.
Yeah, and when you use the term surgically, I give a caveat to that polyps can be removed during the colonoscopy. So it's not that if someone undergoes a colonoscopy and we find a polyp, then they're sent for surgery. Polyps can be removed during colonoscopy, which is why that is such a great screening tool, because during the test, if we find those polyps, we can actually try to remove them right then and there. There are situations where the polyps are much larger, and then those may need to be removed at another date during a surgery. But for the most part, we can remove polyps during the colonoscopy itself.
Daniel from Homelstown says, people of Eastern European descent should be aware of genetic markers that can tell, let me just make sure I get it right here, that your likeness risk of getting certain cancers, you can get tested for these genetic markers. I don't have the whole email here, mm-hmm. but what do you know what he's talking about?
Yeah, so there are certain genetic markers for colon cancer syndromes, and that's where the detailed history when the patients and physicians meet come into play. Mm-hmm. Because as we go over their history, we also go over family history. And with family history, if we see multiple cancers in their family, that can lead to genetic testing and screening and then earlier colonoscopy. So that's why the communication between the patient and the doctor is so key.
Mm-hmm.
to get that information.
Colon cancer versus rectum cancer, obviously we're talking about two different parts of the body, but what is the difference? Is there a difference?
Well, it's basically a continuum. The rectum is the very beginning portion of the colon when we insert the scope. So they are evaluated at the same time.
But are there polyps that only form on the rectum or polyps that only form in the colon?
So polyps can form in both locations.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, and that's why we pretty much, I said about colon cancer being the second leading cause of death. Am I accurate in that or is it colorectal?
They're basically kind of lumped together. So we say colorectal cancer.
Uh-huh. Okay. Want to turn to Mike McCormick. Mike, you fortunately did not suffer from colorectal cancer.
Yes.
But I say fortunately, but unfortunately, you had a couple other forms of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you get involved? What there's a fundraiser later this month. What are we talking about?
Well, the fundraiser is Striking Chords Against Cancer. And this is the second annual event that we're having. It is to raise money for our cancer research. It's going to be on July 25th.
Is it? Oh, it's July. Okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're going to have it at the Vineyard of Hershey. And basically what it is, it's a day of music. And we have such great talent here in central Pennsylvania that we want to showcase that. And so we have three musicians, three bands that are playing, and throughout the day, we're selling tickets, we're looking for sponsors, and we've got two food trucks there. The Vineyard has beer, the Vineyard has wine, and it's just a great day, and I'm really looking forward to the second annual.
Well, you know, the point is that obviously, we need to research cancer, no matter what type of cancer. And there are hundreds of cancers out there. I mean, we identify them, we break them down, mm-hmm. but there are hundreds of cancers out there. And even though it seems as though we've been researching cancer for the past 100 years, there's still so much more we don't know. So fundraisers like this are very important.
Yes, absolutely. One of the really neat things about the American Cancer Society and the funding that comes in for cancer research, the Nobel Prize has been awarded, I believe, 73 or 74 times since 1946. 48 times the person or the people that have been awarded that Nobel Prize in Medicine and Physiology were funded by the American Cancer Society for their research.
Mm.
So the money that you're putting towards an event like Striking Chords Against Cancer is going towards a great cause, and they're doing great things with that money.
You know, it brings up a point, and this is kind of a big picture question, and both of you can weigh in on this, that, you know, many people look at it and say, yes, okay, we've been researching cancer for so long, but yet we still are dealing with a lot of dangerous, life-threatening cancers.
Mm.
But we've made progress, right? I mean, even colorectal, we've made progress.
Yes, we've made progress. And if you think about early detection, if these polyps and cancers are found early enough, 70% of colon cancer patients can be saved. So that's an amazing statistic.
Go ahead.
Okay. So the first cancer I had was tonsil cancer, and that was brought on by the HPV virus.
Mm.
And now there is a vaccine that teenagers can receive for the HPV virus that will help to eliminate the potential to get head and neck cancer, like the cancer that I had. Penile cancer, cervical cancer for girls, women. And these vaccines weren't available years ago. You know, when I was a kid, who knew about that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm.
If you can get your child in to get this vaccination, that child probably isn't going to go through the suffering that I have had to go through with the treatments that I had.
I have to admit that I didn't even realize that there was tonsil cancer, mm-hmm. and then cancer of the tongue, you know, I've heard of, but that doesn't seem to be a cancer you hear of very often.
Well, you don't hear of it, but it's amazing the amount of people that I have talked to that have a family member that has had tongue cancer, a family member, a friend who had colorectal cancer. I had colorectal cancer in 2005. I had to have radiation treatment 8 weeks, five days for 8 weeks. I had 3 chemotherapy sessions. That was a very rough experience. And the reason I got the tongue cancer is because I had the radiation treatment for the colorectal cancer.
Are you cancer-free now?
I am cancer-free now.
Congratulations.
Yes, thank you very much.
Glad to hear that. Let's take a phone call from Dave in Dillsburg. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to let you know, to make the prep for the colonoscopy a little less unpleasant, it's what you eat before. The day or two before, you know, you want to stop your fast food restaurants. Don't eat steak every day, because what you put in your mouth, it's got to come out. So the better the food, the vegetables, light soups, your prep for the colonoscopy will not be as bad as you think.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your call. Doctor, is that accurate?
Yes. Yes, I agree with that. If you start eating some lighter foods in the days preceding and then the day before your procedure, it's a clear liquid diet.
I have a story, and laugh if you will, but I had a friend who said he picked the day after the Super Bowl for his colonoscopy. He said that was not a very good decision.
I would agree.
On his part.
I chose the weekend of the Masters to have my vasectomy. I was able to sit and watch.
Well, I was going to say, at least you can sit and watch. Nancy says, can you discuss the sigmoidoscopy briefly? Would you recommend that as a replacement for colonoscopy? I'm not familiar with that.
Sure. So that's a good question, actually. So years ago, rather than having a full colonoscopy, a flexible sigmoidoscopy was used. And that is where the colon is evaluated, but only about, I'd say, about 30-40% of the colon. So you are not getting a look at the entire complete colon. In the past, many years ago, they were using flexible sigmoidoscopy, but not alone. They were using that coupled with another technique called a barium enema to look at the remainder of the colon. So the flexible sigmoidoscopy by itself was not used for screening purposes. It was a flexible sigmoidoscopy plus a barium enema to evaluate the right side of the colon. Now that test is going to the wayside. It's definitely colonoscopy is the gold standard. It's one of those scenarios where something is better than nothing. Mm. So if someone was adamant that they do not want a colonoscopy, then that's an option, but still the detection rate is not equivalent to a colonoscopy.
Hold on just 1 second. I have about 2 minutes here. Linda says, my husband wouldn't listen to me and get screened. Then he had a gallstone blocking a bile duct in 2012. They found a strange flat polyp on his duodenum.
Duodenum, that's the beginning of the small intestines.
It was precancerous and scared him into a colonoscopy. They found 7 more polyps and three or four of them were precancerous. He's now checked every 3 years, mm-hmm. but he had to be scared into getting the colonoscopy. Mm-hmm. We've seen these TV commercials for screening that don't involve a colonoscopy, that you would send a sample in. Is that for everyone?
So that is called Cologuard, and you've probably seen those commercials on TV. That test is specifically for a subset of patients who are completely average risk. That means patients who do not have any history, any family history of colon cancer, any history of precancerous colon polyps, or have any chronic bowel conditions like ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease. They cannot have any of those in order to qualify for Cologuard.
What percentage of people is that?
So for the average risk individual, yes, I don't have the exact percentage mm-hmm. for that, but they can qualify for that test. And what they have to remember is that test is not 100%. So yes, it can pick up a high percentage of colon cancers and precancerous polyps, but there is a percentage that are missed. But it is a great tool for the individual who is trying not to have a colonoscopy, because if that comes back positive, that is more weight that, yes, you need a colonoscopy.
We're almost out of time. I want to thank both of you for being on the program. Dr. Purvi Panchal, she's with Pennsylvania Gastroenterology, affiliated with Geisinger Health, and Mike McCormick as a financial advisor living in Hershey. I want to thank both of you for being on the program today.
Thank you.
For more information on cancer screening plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITS Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. Tomorrow on the program, we talk about Real ID. That's on tomorrow's Smart Talk.